Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed, your host. Today, we'll take a close look at what the FBI is doing to prevent terrorist attacks during mass demonstrations in the United States. And we'll examine what is happening to protesters who are targeted for undercover operations that use paid informants to infiltrate their lives. Joining us in the studio at Reynolds Journalism Institute are Petra Bartoshevitz. She's a freelance journalist and author of several in-depth articles on the FBI's sting operations, and also Christina Wells, a law professor here at the University of Missouri who specializes in cases involving free speech issues. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
The government's effort to balance security concerns and civil liberties has gone overboard in the past. The most popular drama in movie theaters across America this week is called J. Edgar. The film is directed by Clint Eastwood and stars Leonardo DiCaprio as J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation for nearly 50 years. Hoover ran a secret domestic surveillance operation called COINTELPRO. The counterintelligence program was designed to monitor and neutralize domestic groups deemed by the FBI to be a danger to national security. Such groups included anti-war groups and civil rights groups and individuals, including Martin Luther King Jr. and even Eleanor Roosevelt. One of the most talked about documentaries released this year is called Better This World. The film is directed by Katie Galloway, and it focuses on the government's case against two Texas boyhood friends who were accused of domestic terrorism during the 2008 Republican National Convention in Minneapolis. Galloway could not join us here in the studio, but I spoke with the director outside the theater last night. What inspired you to do this documentary?
I saw an article in the New York Times. It struck a chord with me because since 9/11, I had heard about a lot of these domestic terrorism cases where there had been, you know, big flashbulbs and headlines about a domestic terror arrest. And then shortly thereafter, there was some kind of counter-allegation by the defense of entrapment or of some kind of misconduct by a government agent or informant. And so when we read this story about David McKay and Bradley Crowder, David McKay was just about to start federal trial. And so that doesn't happen very often. Not many people go to trial in these cases or in any cases in the federal system. And so we thought it would be an opportunity to look really up close and, you know, in detail at one case as told by the prosecutor and the defense attorney. And so we hopped on a plane to Minneapolis and started to find out more about the story.
The documentary was screened here in Columbia last night, and it follows David McKay, who was 22 at the time, and Bradley Crowder, who was 23, as they befriend a radical activist who turns out to be an FBI informant. In jailhouse interviews, they described their motivations for joining the convention demonstrations.
I wanted to go to the RNC to protest because I want to change the world, and I believe it can be changed. I felt, and I think many other people felt, that it was time to step up our level of commitment.
We had purpose behind our actions. It's like there was a point greater than ourselves.
The problems we face are, like, epic and dangerous. You know, torture, preemptive warfare, corporate corruption, poverty, the prison system, economic suicide. So all of these things, to me, were tied in, and the Republicans were the ruling party over that time, and so they bore a lot of the responsibility for a lot of the crime.
I think that it was really fertile ground for a radical reaction to prove to people that not everybody felt the way that our government was portraying the American people.
We felt like somebody had to speak up.
Now, in this following clip of three comments from the documentary, The head of the FBI's security branch, Tim Gosfeld, talks about terrorism prevention in general, and then an FBI agent describes convention security, and then Gosfeld tells us why these two Texans were targets of the undercover operation.
September 11th really underscored the fact that prevention of terrorism is the number one goal of the FBI. That is what we need to focus all our resources on to the best of our ability.
We had to absolutely be prepared for a catastrophic terrorism incident, and really the planning ideology that we used was that we had to assume that there was a 100% chance that there was going to be an attack, and we had to be prepared for it.
This case was investigated by the FBI and by the Secret Service as a domestic terrorism case. What these two young men had in mind was to come to Minneapolis to disrupt a national political convention through violent means.
Before a panel discussion about the film last night, I asked Galloway about the movie's message.
What we most wanted people to come away with was a deep look at a single case that was most likely to be told in black and white terms. In the media, in the justice system, there's not really room for gray and the sort of full range of humanity and how people got into this crazy situation that you read about in the paper. We wanted people to understand that there's much more to the cases than you read about in the paper. The little bits of bursts of news that you hear about these domestic terrorism cases and about so much in the world we live in, it's not the full story. And so we saw this, just this investigation initially as an opportunity for us to better understand it. But once we, you know, sort of really understood the story deeply and were putting the film together, we hoped that that would help people reflect on all these other cases since 9/11 and on the justice system and the way that it operates more broadly in a different, in a more astute, perhaps a more critical way.
What worries you about the balance between free expression and national security and how the FBI is operating in these cases?
I think it's best summed up in a multiple choice question on a Department of Defense exam from 2009. There was a question for all incoming staff at the Department of Defense, which was, which of the following is low-level terrorism, quote-unquote. And the correct answer was protest. And that, I thought, was harrowing because, obviously, protest should not be equated or conflated with terrorism. But I think this case, that multiple-choice question, and much of what we've seen post 9/11 has been a dangerous merging of terrorism and protest or dissent in the eyes of many authorities.
Chris, after you watched the film last night again and listened to the panel discussion afterward, what was your takeaway about this balance?
I think the statement that the FBI agent made about the FBI's role being increasingly prevention of crime, as opposed to what most people and certainly in the legal world think of as criminal law and law enforcement officers' primary role being as the detection and punishment of crime. So when you your role changes from punishment and detection of crime to prevention of crime, I think two things that really started to come out of that, especially when protesters are involved. The first is this really significant concern that I think people are starting to express about the government targeting innocent or peaceful activists and protesters for no real apparent reason other than this amorphous concern over national security, which is hard to define, amorphous, never really defined. There's never any attempt to even do that. And as a result, they target people, to use informants, and there's this creation of terrorists in some ways, and there have been a lot of criticisms of the FBI for having done that, having targeted a group, created terrorists, and then announcing, we've found a terrorist cell here in the United States. That targeting is a real problem. And then the other thing is what Katie referred to, which is this conflation of terrorists and protests. The idea that protests are somehow problematic simply because they're large or that there may be some unrest associated with them and that they're automatically viewed with suspicion is problematic. We've always had an uneasy relationship with protesters simply because people who protest tend to be very passionate about what they do. But increasingly, we see this sort of line between protesters and terrorism blurred for no apparent reason.
Petra, could you put these tactics in historical perspective?
Sure. Well, I think 9/11 was a huge dividing line historically in terms of how we think about terrorism and how we deal with it. And Chris mentioned the preventive paradigm, which was an enormous sea change in law enforcement. And it comes from a good place. You know, we want to be safe. We want to be safe from another attack. That's a very reasonable it sounds like a very reasonable mandate, and it is. Nobody wants to see another attack. The question is whether the cases that have resulted in the decade since 9/11 have actually made us safer from a terrorist attack. And when you start to look at the 1,000-plus defendants who have been charged with terrorism-related crimes since 9/11, the marquee cases repeatedly are preventative operations that target overwhelmingly so far Muslim males, many of them immigrants. And the biggest cases we've seen are sting operations where essentially, and this happened even pre-9/11 in drug cases, for example, FBI agents suspect, the FBI or the Justice Department suspects the individuals of potentially being capable of a crime. They often use informants to go into the community to see if they can set up an opportunity. They call it an opportunity to create a crime. The difference between these opportunities pre-9/11 and post-9/11 is that the rules governing how these investigations can be shaped have been loosened dramatically. Individuals who are not suspected of any prior crimes can be surveilled, many of them for long periods of time. And informants are given much more free rein in terms of helping to formulate the crime. We've seen cases where the government provides the logistics, the weapons. They script the details of the plot. And again, these individuals often, the defendants, agree to commit some kind of a crime, which certainly makes them criminal. But whether they have that political motivation that elevates this crime to a crime of terrorism is a completely different question. And I also think it's notable that in the biggest cases where an attack has been attempted, and we're probably familiar with those, the Times Square bomber, the shoe bomber, the underwear bomber, those attacks were deterred not thanks to any of these enhanced surveillance and security measures that have been brought in since 9/11, but because the perpetrators themselves failed to complete the act. They could not detonate the bomb. They were incompetent, essentially.
How has this changing role of informants affected free speech and the right to protest?
Well, they're certainly being used more, groups will tell you that they've started changing the ways that they communicate. They don't write things down. They're afraid to communicate in ways that they think will be used against them. I think the First Amendment doesn't protect just free speech right. It also protects your right to associate as a group. And that's a very important right. And it goes back largely in many ways to the COINTELPRO operations where the government was trying to get lists of people in groups. And the court said, no, you can't do that. Your right to be part of a group is an important right. And the government's attempt to find out who's a member of the group and then sort of break the group up is inappropriate and violates that right. This right to association, I think people feel, is really becoming burdened by the notion that these informants can come in. They can start to sort of try to breed distrust, and the notion that somebody's in your religious community, et cetera, that you can't trust anyone, it makes that bond much harder to form. And so there is a significant burden when people come in and try to sort of, for lack of a better word, rabble-rouse.
Okay. And also the scope of what's deemed to be a security threat has changed also, hasn't it, Petra?
Well, it's certainly widened since 9/11. And this is something that started even before the 9/11 attacks. There was an effort to pass legislation to make acts of animal rights, radical animal rights activism, an act of terrorism in terms of any kind of property violation, property damage. This didn't succeed, but after 9/11, under this new mandate, there was a law passed, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which essentially makes a crime of domestic terrorism any interference with an animal-related enterprise. That can be a biomedical researcher or a clothing manufacturer or a grocery store. And what this does is, I think it does have a chilling effect on both on legitimate forms of protest, and it certainly, we have laws on the books already that make an act of arson a criminal act, and it is punishable. And we have punished people for doing that in the past. So, but adding that that dimension of terrorism to it, you know, there's a much higher sentence if you're convicted. And I think it really gives people pause that, you know, they have to ask themselves whether any kind of interference, what does that mean? It's a very vague term, and I think that does have an impact on both the legitimate and what would have, even before 9/11, been illegal.
Okay. Now, before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to today's program on our website. And please send us questions or comments via globaljournalistprogram@gmail.com or our Facebook page. Now, Petretta, you have done some, you know, in-depth work on this issue. Tell us a little bit about the cases you looked at and how you tried to be fair to both the FBI's point of view and the people who were caught in these operations' point of view.
I've been following a lot of the bigger sting operations since 9/11 that involve a lot of the cases involve Muslims. But, you know, I have talked to a lot of FBI agents and prosecutors, and I do think that in many ways they are laboring under an impossible mandate. And preventing something before it happens, it's not institutionally how the FBI was designed. I think that there is a push to produce some kind of a result, a case, a prosecutable case. That is what the FBI has historically done. And now they're essentially being asked to become an intelligence gathering agency. And this is an enormous pressure that, you know, I think it's an impossible mandate. And until policies change in some way, these kinds of cases will continue. We see the Attorney General Eric Holder last year saying these sting operations are an important component of the war on terrorism, and the use of informants is a key tool that we have. So I don't see any change on the horizon. But I also understand why, I think more and more, why these cases are coming about. From the perspective of the defendants, you know, I think they do know that in some cases they've done wrong, but they don't describe them. I don't think that they have that political motivation that would make them terrorists. There's a lot of room for interpretation until you get down to the actual charges, and then the legal process takes over, and it becomes very hard to see the gray area, as Katie was describing on the clip that we heard.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about what's happening now with the Occupy Wall Street protests around the country, and there was some violence that broke out in Oakland, and there was more demonstrations after that against what was considered to be heavy-handed tactics by the police. How, with the Occupy Wall Street protests, do you think that the FBI has informants working in these places now?
I don't know if it's the FBI in particular, but absolutely law enforcement does. And there's no question but that they have people undercover working in all of those places.
And do you think that one of these cases might come out of Occupy Wall Street?
I don't know if a case like the one that we saw in Better This World is going to come out of it. I mean, it's certainly possible. But I do think that what you're seeing with the increasing use of informants is part of this trend of institutionalizing emergency measures that have sort of been ushered in over the past decade. And that really means, in practical terms, increased surveillance, increasing militarized response to organized protest. The Oakland protesters were met with some very, very violent kinds of response from the police. And this comes down to the Homeland Security dollars that are funding the local and the state police. Another kind of legacy of 9/11 is in the increasing conflation and fusion, is the term law enforcement uses, of local, state, and federal resources to gather intelligence and share intelligence of all kinds through average Americans. And how this data is then used is still kind of being hashed out. But certainly, we're seeing not the kind of 9/11 tactics being applied to a completely different situation, which has nothing to do with terrorism. There's no even question of terrorism at these Occupy, whether it's Wall Street or in another city across the country.
Do you find that they just extended the Patriot Act, mm-hmm. For another duration of time? Is the problem we're having partly due to the word terrorism itself and the efforts to define it?
Well, we don't really have a very good definition of terrorism. I mean, we have some federal statutes that define terrorist organizations, but those are largely international, right? So material support laws, you can be arrested at the federal level for giving support to terrorist organizations. But that's a very specific issue with respect to international terrorism. At the domestic level, we don't really have domestic terrorism laws. We have crimes that you can commit, for example, throwing an incendiary device, which is at the core of Better This World and what the two young men are convicted of there. But we use the word terrorism more colloquially, right? And yes, I think we have a lot of trouble figuring out what terrorism is. So you will hear people talk about anti-abortion activists as terrorists. You will hear people talk about the National Socialist Party, which is a neo-Nazi party, as terrorists. You will hear people talk about environmental groups as terrorists. So you will see them use – anyone who uses violence can be easily labeled a terrorist. But at least from a sort of technical standpoint, terrorism is supposed to be someone who uses violence to sort of bring about political change. And usually that means regime change, right? Not just change a law, right, et cetera. But that's not really how we're using it. And so because it has this sort of amorphous sense, like the term national security, right, I think it is partly why we have such trouble countering this notion of, oh, well, these people are terrorists, therefore we should deal with them harshly.
Okay. What do you think the world watching what we're doing now in reaction to these political protests, what they think about what we're doing to try to prevent violent attacks during protests?
Well, I think globally there is a great tradition of protest. We've seen it this year and last year throughout the world, and the fact that the state would come and violently oppose protesters is nothing new I think we've seen it in this country, we've seen it in other countries. The U.S. does put a lot of money, however, into its law enforcement resources, and since 9/11 we've put even more, and we've really increasingly militarized our police domestically. I think that's a trend that other people in other countries recognize and is disturbing to them. And I'm sure, you know, the question is, again, whether this makes us safer. And you do see a kind of framework that pervades the approach of law enforcement. Again, it's the mandate they've been given, so it's understandable why. But they investigated this case in Better This World at the Republican National Convention as a domestic terrorism case. Nothing had happened yet. No bombs had been built, no Molotov cocktails thrown. In fact, by the time these two young men were arrested, they still hadn't thrown a single Molotov cocktail. How we frame these cases is very important in terms of how we approach them.
Now, as a journalist, what got you interested in dedicating your life to looking at this issue?
I followed. I sort of stumbled across a trial in 2005 It was a sting operation. It involved an informant. The defendant in the case was asked to produce a missile for an alleged terrorist group. After a year of trying, he failed to do so. And so the FBI, in cooperation with the Russian government, actually provided the missile for him. And so when I saw that one of the marquee terrorism cases that we were prosecuting in the war on terror involved a man where the government was on both sides of the deal, I really wondered what the value of that case was given the amount of resources that went into it. And I started to look at more of the cases and saw a lot of parallels.
Okay. And Chris, you've written about this, about free speech issues quite a bit. What's drawn you to this issue?
This security issue in particular or freedom of speech?
Well, both, how they intersect. Yeah.
Well, the national security issue, largely it was John Ashcroft's statement in 2001, sort of largely accusing people who criticized the government of being unpatriotic. I suspect that my head nearly exploded when I heard that. And it just occurred to me that was the least patriotic thing I'd ever heard someone say, the idea that people who were trying to give the government their opinion was unpatriotic, especially given my background in freedom of speech. So that's sort of what got me interested in this. And of course, all of the free speech cases begin as Sedition Act sort of cases in some ways. They owe their existence to cases about criticizing the government. But my interest in free speech just largely goes back to, I think, parents who taught me to question everything, right? I mean, I'm a skeptic at heart, and so you're naturally drawn to free speech.
Great. Well, so we've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist. Thank you, Petra, and for joining us, and Chris. And make sure to visit petrabart.com to see all of Petra's work. And thank you, Christina, for joining us. This has been a very fascinating discussion of a difficult balancing act, one that seems to be tipping too far in the direction of security concerns at the expense of civil rights and freedom of expression. Stay tuned for Free Press Watch. Our director is Joe Deutschman. Pat Akers engineered the audio. Raymond Tungerkar is our executive producer. David Cawthon is the lead producer for this show, assisted by Jessica Popovac and Ryan Kress. Thank you for listening and watching our program.
And now, Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalist where each week we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Jessica Popovac. This week's reports come from the Committee to Protect Journalists and Wire Services. In New York this week, police officers arrested at least 7 members of the media during the Occupy Wall Street crackdown. Several of them reported being arrested despite showing their credentials. Among them were a reporter and a photographer with the Associated Press, both of whom were released 4 hours later. And in Ethiopia last week, a federal judge charged 6 journalists with terrorism under a 2009 law that criminalizes any reporting that provides moral support to groups deemed terrorist entities. The charges bring the number of journalists charged under the statute since June to 10. 5 of them, however, are currently in exile and were charged in absentia. The Committee to Protect Journalists claims that the charges have been lodged only against reporters critical of Ethiopia's current prime minister and are without merit. And in Mexico, threats to freedom of the press continued this week as 2 journalists disappeared and the offices of a daily newspaper were attacked. The reporter and driver with the daily paper El Financiero disappeared from the central Mexican state of Zacatecas on Monday in a vehicle marked with the paper's logo. Their last communication stated that they were being followed by 2 police cars. Then, later that same week, the offices of the Mexican daily El Siglo de Torreón were shot at, and a car outside of the building was set on fire. Mexico continues to be one of the most dangerous countries in the world for members of the press, according to CPJ reports. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please go to our website at www.globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. See you next week.